Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's major stories. The Associated Press's Josh Boak and Jeff Horowitz report that when Donald Trump named his Treasury Secretary, Tina Colebrook felt her heart sink. She had voted for Donald Trump on the belief that he would knock the moneyed elites from their perch in Washington, and she knew Trump's pick for Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, all too well. One West, a bank formerly owned by a group of investors headed by Mnuchin, had foreclosed on her Los Angeles area home in the aftermath of the recession, stripping her of the two units she rented as a primary source of income. Colebrook told Reuters, quote, "I just wish that I had not voted. I have no faith in our government anymore at all. They all promise you the world at the end of a stick and take it away once they get in," end quote. Less than a month after Donald Trump's win, his populist appeal has started to clash with a cabinet of billionaires and millionaires that he believes can energize economic growth. That story got a lot of attention. The media are widely covering Steve Mnuchin, the millions he made from the foreclosure crisis, and his plans for deregulation, stripping back parts of Dodd-Frank, and massive corporate tax cuts. He was also Donald Trump's top fundraiser, and like so many picks, he has no government experience. On today's Media Roundtable, we are also discussing coverage of the failed referendum in Italy. On Sunday, nearly 60% of Italian voters rejected changes to the Constitution, causing Prime Minister Matteo Renzi to resign. Joining us to talk about these stories are three journalists. Eric Regoli is the European columnist for the Globe and Mail based in Rome. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be back, Rose.
Great to have you. Jesse Eisinger is senior investigative reporter with ProPublica. Jesse and his colleagues won the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series of stories on Wall Street practices that caused the 2008 financial crisis, the worst since the Great Recession. Hi, Jesse. Welcome to the show. Kevin Hall is chief national economics correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. In 2010, Kevin was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for national reporting about how Wall Street sold out investors and caused the financial crisis. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off by highlighting positive journalism, journalism that really stood out this week. So Eric Regoli, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
This story I really love, Rose. And speaking of Donald Trump, it's called "Meet the Press." It appeared in the Washington Spectator, not the American Spectator, but the Washington Spectator. On December 6th, written by Rick Perlstein. I think the subtitle says it all. It says it's about the quote the hustlers, hucksters, hacks, and cowards who helped elect Donald Trump, and really, it's an in-depth and amusing analysis of how the press went after Hillary Clinton much more than Donald Trump, and much more than his cabinet appointees. So I thought it was a superb piece.
I read part of that, and it's starting to get a little bit of traction. As someone who covers economic issues from Rome, what really stood out for you in this story?
Well, it's just how lame the U.S. press was in covering the election. Most of the attacks were against Hillary and the email scandal, and it seemed very much one-sided. Though having said that, in Europe too, the attack journalism can be very, very one-sided here as well. But I'm a Canadian Italian living in Europe for the last decade, we always held up American journalism as much fairer than European journalism and much more aggressive, and it doesn't look like this was the case in the U.S. election.
Mm. And since you are in Rome, how is this being covered in Italy and the European papers that you read?
About Donald Trump and his cabinet appointees?
Yes.
Well, a shock and horror. Most of Europe, certainly Italy, was against Trump and more in favor of Hillary, even though they knew Hillary had faults. I mean, the Italians don't like Hillary's involvement in Libya, which helped give Italy the refugee crisis. But by and large, they're very much in favor of Hillary over Trump. So, This is not being viewed well by the Europeans.
Mm. Well, kudos to Rick Perlstein for his piece called Meet the Press, The Hustlers, Hucksters, Hacks, and Cowards Who Helped Elect Donald Trump. And he writes about research he did on theories about why great civilizations fall. And he said, none I could find mentioned that what may become future historians' most convincing explanation for America's fall, should Donald Trump end up the finisher, bad journalism. That's how he put it. And we'll put a link to that right after the show. Thank you for that, Eric. That's Eric Regeli, European columnist with the Globe and Mail. And what about you, Kevin? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I hate to be so mainstream here, but I'll point to a very thorough New York Times 4-byline piece on business since birth, Trump's children, and the tangle that awaits. This may be a bit myopic on my part since I'm looking narrowly at the issue quite a bit myself, but it is a very thorough piece on the kind of this no bright lines between where their business and family interests are, the fact that titles don't much mean anything in the company. It operates like a gigantic mom-and-pop company. And frankly, and I'll push back on the earlier comments about what the mainstream press did or didn't do in the campaign, but one of the things that was challenging was the structure of a privately held company, a very private family that does not have a lot of footprint despite having a lot of investment. And all of that made it very difficult to cover, whereas the WikiLeaks emails were, you know, you can't ignore them, you've got to cover them. So all that, this tangle, is going to be a challenge going forward. It was a challenge during the campaign, and I think the Times, by its own admission, didn't do a great job, but I think did a very good job on this this story.
And Kevin, you're going to be covering Donald Trump's finances all throughout 2017. What is at the top of your list?
Well, we've got a lot of things planned, but the first order of business is understanding next week how he's going to separate himself from his business. The betting money isn't on a clean break, and we've already seen some anomalies, like the Office of Government Ethics basically tweeting out privileged information about what they talked with his lawyers, trying to kind of force him or pressure him to make a clean break with his businesses, which is pretty much unheard of. And so the first order of business is next on December 15th, which I think is Wednesday, isn't it? Thursday. Is going to tell us a lot about whether we're going to be writing for the next 4 years about this conflict of interest, or whether he's actually making a clean break.
Well, we will definitely look for that piece, and we will link to all of these stories at yourcallradio.org. Let's dive in here now and talk about media coverage of what's happening in Italy. Last Sunday, about 60% of Italian voters rejected Prime Minister Matteo Renzi's call to reform the country's constitution, which would have made it easier for the government to pass laws. And before this happened, there wasn't much coverage on this. It's now getting more coverage. But Eric, some of the articles are really confusing. Can you first of all describe what would this referendum have done?
Okay, it is confusing, but the referendum was a referendum on constitutional change. At its most basic, Rose, it was to end the Italian Parliament's perfectly bicameral system. There's a lower house and an upper house, but they have exactly equal power. So the referendum, in its essence, was to eliminate the upper house, which is called the Senate, and strip it of almost all its lawmaking abilities and concentrate almost all power in the lower house, which is called the Chamber of Deputies, which would be the equivalent of the U.S. House of Representatives. So it was billed as streamlining government and simplifying it, allowing laws to pass more quickly, and also saving costs. And Matteo Renzi, the former prime minister now, lost that bid. He had staked his entire future on it and went down in flames. It was a huge margin against him, and he is out.
Can you tell us just briefly about the political makeup of Italy? you have the Democratic Party, and then can you also tell us about the Five Star Movement? This is a movement that has pledged to carry out a referendum on whether Italy should remain in the EU. It wants to free Italy from the euro, and the Five Star Movement recently won mayoral elections in Rome and Turin. And I ask this because I didn't know much about the Five Star Movement. Just reading about this, I realized that Italian politics just doesn't get much attention in the U.S. media.
Well, the five-star movement, you're going to be hearing a lot more of them. It looks like Italy's going to have an election next year. The election had not been scheduled till 2018. So you're going to have three of Europe's biggest countries having election next year: France, Germany, and Italy. The one that is most likely to elect a populist anti-Euro as opposed to anti-EU government is Italy. And I've always said that, you know, I believe this, that the Eurozone lives and dies in Rome, not in Brussels or anywhere else. Now, why is this going to happen? The Five Star Movement, which is already the biggest elected populist party in Europe, is polling at 30%. And the referendum, the no vote in the referendum, was a huge victory for the Five Star Movement, which had been encouraged a no vote, and they won that no vote. And now, since they have all this political momentum, they are really pushing hard for a snap election. Unlikely to happen in the next few months, but pretty certain it will happen sometime in 2017. So we could have a populist anti-Euro government in a G7 country in Europe pretty soon.
Wow. And 80% of people between the ages of 18 and 24 voted no. You have reported that the youth unemployment rate is about 37% in Italy. That is so high. And so many articles are pointing to populism to explain this vote. But you say that the vote has a lot more to do with the lack of jobs in Italy.
Well, I think so, Rose. I mean, certainly populism is part of it, but you got to remember that, if I could just step back for one second, Matteo Renzi, the former prime minister, made the huge mistake of personalizing this vote. He said, if the referendum goes against me, I'm out of here. And so the referendum, in effect, became a plebiscite on his two-year track record. He came in promising jobs, an economic turnaround. That didn't happen. The youth unemployment rate in Italy, as you mentioned, is almost 40%. In Sicily, it's almost 60%. I was there recently. And the jobs are not just coming back. So I think there was a huge economic component to this referendum. It was punishment for failure to turn around the Italian economy. And the 80% of young people did vote no, and something like 50% of young people are in favor of the five-star movement. And if it does get elected, it's going to be the youth vote that's going to get them in.
Rose, can I ask a quick question of Eric?
Please, Kevin.
My understanding was that Renzi's party still has the overwhelming largest voting bloc. Do they have someone who's young and dynamic who could step in if they held serve for protracted period that could attract these younger voters?
No, and that's the problem. Renzi is young and allegedly dynamic. He's 41, and there is no. I mean, Italy is a country of really old, white, ailing politicians, and this means he could, despite his crushing defeat in the referendum, make a comeback, because there's really no one in the center left, the Democratic Party, who seems dynamic enough to preserve this center left rule in this country.
And what about any left parties?
Well, the Democratic Party of Matteo Renzi is center left. I mean, you know, a generation ago they were known as the communists. So they are the center. Italy is roughly divided into three groups. There's the center-left, the center-right, which includes Silvio Berlusconi's old party. He's still a force to be reckoned with here, even though he has been indicted and he's 80 years old and cannot step into parliament. And then there's the five-star movement. They're roughly polling center-right, center-left, and five-star, which is both left and right, about 30% each.
Today we are speaking with Eric Reguli, European columnist with the Globe and Mail based in Rome. We are talking about the referendum that went down in Italy, and we're also joined by Kevin Hall, chief national economics correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. And then talk a little bit about the banking crisis that's happening in Italy. Italy is Europe's fourth largest economy, and the Italian bank Monte dei Paschi di Siena, the oldest bank in the world, needs about $5.5 billion to stay open. There are reports that the government might step in to save that bank. Is that true?
Yes, this is actually a huge story, and it's not just an Italian story. The contagion effect could kick in if this bank fails. It's the third biggest bank in Italy. It was formed in 1472, when 20 years before Christopher Columbus sailed to America. And it's been through world wars, plagues, pestilence, but it can't get through this crisis now. It is totally laden with dead loans that'll never be paid back, and the government looks like it's going to have to step in and bail it out. But I tell you, if it's not bailed out, if it collapses, the repercussions, it'll trigger a Europe-wide banking crisis. It could actually splash into North America. That's how big this bank is. So this is really one to watch. It's really quite scary. The Italian government could have recapitalized this bank 2 or 3 years ago and avoided this crisis, but it was just kicking the can down the road.
Wow. How could it affect North America?
Well, you saw what happened in 2008. I'm not saying there's not going to be another global financial crisis if Monte dei Paschi fails, but what we learned from the financial crisis in 2008 is just how interconnected the world's banks are. It's instant transmission of problems from one bank to another. And Monte dei Paschi is a really, really big bank. I mean, Italy's a huge economy. I mean, I'm Canadian. It's much bigger than Canada. It's the third biggest economy in the Eurozone. It has the world's third biggest debt load. It's really big here. And if this bank goes down, there's going to be a lot of casualties across Europe and maybe even in North America.
Kevin, what would you add to that?
Oh, just that it reminds of how frustrated the Germans are that nobody else seems to be playing by the rules or tightening their belt, or it kind of underscores it. You know, Italy was not one of the so-called pigs, the Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain, but it was on the border of being one of the pigs, and for lack of a better acronym. And it certainly is of greater magnitude. I know Spain had, a lot of people were afraid that it would be Spain that would kind of spark this contagion. Italy, I'm certainly far less an expert than Eric, but Italy always seems to be on the verge and somehow seems to hold it together. I'll remind that they've had their Trump already in Berlusconi, so we have a lot to learn from Italy in some respects.
And Eric, what about programs under the Democrats in Italy? What are people on the streets saying about this party?
Well, it's the Matteo Renzi's. He's still head of the party, by the way. He's just not prime minister anymore. It's a wounded beast. This is supposed to be the great hope of Italy under this dynamic young leader, and it turned out not to be. What I'm hearing, what the polls say, is that the Five Star Movement's going to win the next election. I do believe that. And I do believe it's going to be propelled, their victory is going to be propelled by the young and jobless, of whom there are millions in this country. And the problem with the Five Star Movement is that, well, A, they're inexperienced, but they're very vague. They don't really, we know what they're against. They're against everyone but themselves, or against corruption. They want to hold a referendum on the euro, but we don't really know what they're for, and they don't really have a platform. In quick example, they want a guaranteed annual wage in this country. And this is an idea that's been floating around for decades. But they don't say how they're going to fund it. And this country is, you know, almost bankrupt. How are you going to fund this?
What would that look like? Are they throwing out specific numbers?
No, and that's a problem. They say we think there should be a guaranteed annual wage. Fine. how are you going to fund it? And when you have when your debt is equivalent to 130% of GDP, of gross domestic product, how do you fund it? They can't even afford to bail out banks in this country.
Wow.
You know, how many billions of euros would a guaranteed annual salary cost? I mean, I don't think it's a bad idea if you can pay for it.
Mm.
Think about Kevin. Just that 130% reference that Eric just made, and that the U.S. is in the ballpark of 80% right now, and every proposal from both left and right in the United States is still keeps us in that 75 to 80% range for the next 20 years. Mr. Trump's proposals would put us well in about the 105% of debt to GDP. We're not that far behind Italy, and I think that the biggest takeaway is if Italy were to really be rocked with problems that spread, we're not in a very good place to be able to respond. Right now we're the clean shirt in the dirty pile, but we have our own structural issues because we have such a high debt load coming out of this nearly 10-year now clawback from the financial crisis.
Yeah, and Kevin, that's a really good point. I mean, the economist Kenneth Rogoff published that study a few years ago, saying that once your debt gets to 80% of GDP, growth really starts to suffer. And look what's happening to Italy, and it could happen to the United States. And God forbid, if interest rates keep going up, they're very low right now. But if you're carrying north 100% GDP and interest rates go from 2 to 4%, that's a doubling.
Hmm. Eric,
cost to refinance.
What about social movements in Italy? How are youth responding to these high unemployment rates?
Well, the educated ones are leaving. There's a net outflow of migration in Italy, mostly the young and talented. When I go to Berlin, London, Toronto, I mean, I'm hearing more Italian. I'm not exaggerating than other languages. Everyone leaves. A lot of young people can't afford to leave, though. So the educated ones are leaving, and every Italian parent we know is trying to get their kids into some sort of English language high school or university. But again, there's not a lot of money in this country, so the privileged, the wealthy, are going to get out.
And what about the state of the media in Italy?
The state of the media, interesting question. It's very political here. You have newspapers that are identified with political parties. The state of the media is terrible. I mean, financially, as it is in many countries, but they are supported politically to some degree.
And what's next?
Well, what next is we need a prime minister, and then we need a new electoral law in Italy, and then we need an election, and it's going to happen pretty fast, because the problem is, if it doesn't happen fast, this banking crisis could accelerate. No investor is going to come and invest in Monte dei Paschi or the biggest bank in Italy, UniCredit, which is also trying to raise billions of euros in new equity, unless a government's in place, and we don't know who the prime minister is going to be. We don't know if the existing finance minister is still going to be finance minister. It's a real mess here.
Wow. Well, we will follow your reporting. And Eric, thanks for bringing us the latest.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That is Eric Reguli. He's European columnist with the Globe and Mail based in Rome. And you can find his pieces at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, we'll continue our conversation with Kevin Hall, chief national economic correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. We'll be talking about media coverage of Steve Mnuchin, Donald Trump's nominee for Treasury Secretary. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up later this evening, it's day six from the CBC in Toronto with Brent Vanbury. Tonight at six. Stay with us here on Local Public Radio, KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll be talking about how scientists are standing up to climate deniers. We'll be joined by climate scientist Michael Mann and the Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist Tom Tolles to talk about their new book, The Madhouse Effect, how climate change denial is threatening our planet, destroying our politics, and driving us crazy. And then we're putting shows together about the future of Medicare with Trudy Lieberman. If you get a chance, get your hands on the latest issue of Harper's Magazine. Trudy has a lengthy, really good piece about Medicare in that magazine. We'll also be talking next week about the importance of shopping local. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we are joined by journalists to talk about coverage of the week's major stories. Kevin Hall is chief national economic correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. In 2010, Kevin was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for national reporting about how Wall Street sold out investors and caused the financial crisis. And now I would like to welcome Jesse Eisinger to the show. Jesse is senior investigative reporter with ProPublica. He and his colleagues won the Pulitzer for national reporting for a series of stories on Wall Street practices that caused the 2008 financial crisis. Hi, Jesse. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Before we dive in and talk about Steve Mnuchin, I just wanted to read an email from Jane in Fremont who says, regarding Donald Trump divesting from his businesses, how are we to believe that there will be no mention of business when the Trump family gets together? Complete divestment is not possible, but I believe Trump has no intention of doing this regardless of his public proclamations. Now, Kevin Hall is going to spend 2017 looking at Donald Trump's finances. Jesse, how are you planning to cover Trump and his many business dealings?
Oh, well, that is going to be obviously a major priority for me and people at ProPublica. We're going to devote an enormous amount of reporting resources to covering a wide variety of issues. I think it's going to be hard to prioritize because it's such a target-rich environment. But one obvious major part of our coverage will entail Trump's business relationships and the ongoing conflicts of interest. And I completely agree with the emailer that he is not going to divest in a remotely sufficient way from his businesses, and that this will be an ongoing area of not just conflict of interest, but really, verging on kleptocracy, that notion that you're using the office to enrich yourself and your family. So that's a big issue. But of course, there are other stories that are equally important, whether the Trump administration perverts the norms of our democracy by abusing power. I think that's possible. There's no evidence that he's done anything yet, of course, because he hasn't taken office. And then we're going to be covering what Trump policies, how Trump policies affect Americans, both Americans who are in vulnerable populations, poor immigrant communities, things like that, but also how Trump policies affect Trump voters. And it's likely, it seems from his appointment so far, that Trump voters are going to be some of the Trump voters who expected him to preserve jobs and protect them are going to be sorely disappointed, unfortunately.
Well, when you look at his appointees, he's appointing millionaires, billionaires, climate deniers, anti-labor men and women. He said during the election that he opposed the TPP and NAFTA. He went after Wall Street. I mean, went after Goldman Sachs big time. And now his Treasury Secretary used to work for Goldman Sachs. A lot of people are surprised by this. A lot of Trump supporters in articles have said they're surprised by this. Kevin Hall, do you think that his economic agenda was vetted over the last year well enough?
Vetted by the media?
Yes.
I think we all pretty much wrote as much as we could. The problem with him, and I remember having this protracted discussion in the newsroom, how do you cover someone who has no interest in actually telling the truth or spelling things out or providing a detail? How much truth squatting can you do when his own followers don't care? And, you know, we've done a series of stories on his finances and how to untangle and all that. And I get calls, angry calls from readers saying, "You don't get it. We voted for him. We don't care. Go find another job." You know, so, you know, we're kind of now, I think most of us in the media feel like this is now our call to duty. If the public doesn't care, it's our job to care for them, because clearly this is significant. In terms of the economy, I mean, I think we knew, you know, he said he was going to do things. He never gave details, so it's hard to know. I don't think his cabinet is wildly different than, let's say, Mitt Romney had won. I don't think he has, you know, maybe Linda McMahon and some celebrity-type stuff at the Small Business Administration, but I don't think his picks have been wildly out of the mainstream. Mnuchin is interesting because he is somewhat an unknown. If you look at one common theme, and I think Jesse probably has put his finger on this in the past himself, the common theme around are people who specialize in distressed assets. So these are guys who've all made a lot of money identifying weak fish or, you know, troubled assets, and then, you know, swooped in and rode the wave up and sold it. So it's Wilbur Ross at Commerce, it's Mnuchin at Treasury, Trump himself, it's been a good part of his business model. But then you go several layers out, and you still have these same people, and you that, if anything, Jesse, would you agree that he is surrounding himself with a kind of investor? It's not like the typical investor.
Yeah, although I'd say that Trump was a producer of distressed assets rather
as well.
Than a bottom-feeding investor in them. Yes, no, I think both Mnuchin and Ross especially are exactly that kind of investor, kind of deal-makers. And these guys are sort of zero-sum people who think or tend to think that if the other guy isn't losing on the deal, then you're not winning on it. And that is certainly a kind of worldview and framework that Trump has, and that frames his analysis of trade, especially, I think. And it's simply incorrect.
Yeah, you see that in trade work. Yeah, and you actually see that in his criticism of the union leader. The fellow from the Steelworkers Union who challenged his carrier numbers, where he attacked the guy and said, you know, if he had done a better job, maybe he wouldn't have lost these jobs. Well, you know, does somebody really think that the labor unions haven't been trying to keep these jobs in the last 20 years?
Hmm. Well, let's talk about Steve Mnuchin, and he's getting widespread coverage, a lot of really good coverage, about how he benefited from the foreclosure crisis, how thousands of older people lost their homes because of this. And Jesse, you both have great pieces on this, but Jesse, you write that he got a sweet deal from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So the FDIC seized IndyMac, whose irresponsible mortgage loans failed as the housing bubble burst. You report that, desperate to offload the bank, the FDIC subsidized the takeover by sheltering Steve Mnuchin and his team of investors, including hedge fund managers John Paulson and George Soros, from losses. The investors injected $1.55 billion into the bank, IndyMac, in 2009, and then they changed the name to One West. And then 5 years later, after all of these foreclosures, they sold it to a lender, CIT, for $3 billion, doubling their investment. Let's spend some time talking about how Steve Mnuchin benefited from the housing collapse and the financial crisis of 2008. Can you tell us what you found?
Sure. Well, IndyMac was a very aggressive subprime mortgage lender, mostly in California, mostly in your part of the world, and he had nothing to do with the bank then, but it, like other financial institutions, ran into an enormous amount of problem as the housing bubble burst. It failed, and then the FDIC took it over. When the FDIC takes it over, it absorbs losses and recapitalizes the bank, and then it's trying to avoid taking as too much loss, and so they don't want to take a hit to their insurance, you know, the insurance portfolio. So they then try to find a seller, and a team of investors led by a distressed investor named Flowers, Christopher Flowers, came in with Steve Mnuchin, and they bought up the bank. And FDIC gives good terms for to a variety of investors. I don't think Mnuchin was particularly special in this. It's just a very sweet deal that they got because the FDIC absorbed a lot of losses for IndyMac.
If I could jump in, what was unique about IndyMac is the FDIC usually intervenes in state banks, a state-level bank, smaller regional banks. The size of IndyMac and its portfolio was a very different kind of intervention. You think the Countrywide, which was a non-bank lender, most of the other bad subprime actors were absorbed by Wall Street because they were kind of part of this whole chain that both Jesse and I wrote about in successive years of this, the old chain of, you know, rolling loan gathers no loss. They were integrated in how they did all these subprime mortgages, packaged them into bonds, sold them to foreign investors. But the fact that IndyMac was taken over by the FDIC was unique. Its size was much larger than the normal FDIC intervention. I interrupted. Sorry, Jerry.
Right. It was the reason why the FDIC came in was it was a savings and loan, as Kevin just said. The other mortgage banks were not, and they were they fell into other areas of the kind of broken regulatory system that we had, overseen by other regulators, the Office of Thrift Supervision, which doesn't exist anymore, or the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and so. Those ended up, when they failed Countrywide, then the government needed or wanted to find buyers for that, and so forced big banks or asked big banks, begged big banks to take them over, and also gave kind of sweet terms. So when Bear Stearns failed or was on the verge of failure, J.P. Morgan got very sweet terms to take it over from the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve absorbed a lot of losses there. So, you know, this was a classic issue of privatized gains and socialized losses.
And this bank, One West, had a reputation among activists and borrowers as being one of the more feckless banks, accused of throwing borrowers out of their homes. In fact, some people who were kicked out of their homes protested in front of Steve Mnuchin's home in 2011. Think Progress has a piece called Meet the Victims of Steve Mnuchin's Foreclosure Machine. According to the California Reinvestment Coalition, the bank One West foreclosed on 36,000 families in California alone. Two-thirds of those foreclosures occurred in majority-minority communities. Kevin Hall, David Dayan at The Nation writes, it's not hyperbole to say that every one of those foreclosures were fraudulent.
Well, I don't know about fraudulent, but I do know this is going to be a very, probably the central theme when he goes for his confirmation hearing. And Democrats are clearly, I've talked to enough people, and I'm pretty sure Jesse has too, that this is going to be their chief line of attack against them. There'll be several other lines of attack as well. But I'm a little conflicted on this because I think one of the things that gets missed here is that mortgages weren't held by the bank per se. Remember that we had these structures where mortgages were pulled together in a, what's called a mortgage-backed security. And so decisions, and I've worked with enough borrowers trying to help people refinance to know that the decisions as to whether they foreclose or not has to do with the performance of that pool of securities. So it's not so black and white that a guy says, you know what, they can pay this, but I don't care, I'm going to throw them out. It had to do with some of those things that, you know, you never knew. One borrower to the other would have the exact same situation. And one guy would get a refinance, the other wouldn't, and the determining factor that they never knew was it had to do with the performance of the overall security in which their bond was folded into. So I do think there's a little simplification of when in villainizing him, but clearly all the banks, including his, did a very poor job of working with borrowers to stay in their homes.
Well, Politico writes about a 90-year-old woman who lost her home after a 27-cent payment error. She sent in a check and forgot to include 27 cents, and then she sent in another check and put in the wrong amount, and then she was foreclosed.
Yeah, I mean, the horror stories. I've been on the inside of this working with five families to refinance to help inform my writing back in 2010 time frame. And you can't imagine how awful and faceless these bank systems are. They have no way of resolving any issue.
And what about the Obama administration's role in all of this? I mean, it's almost full circle, because the failure of Obama to really crack down on all of this resulted in a lot of these people still suffering. And Think Progress points out that a Texas employee back in 2009 gave a deposition that she was forced to partake in the robo-signing. So basically mortgage officials signing off on foreclosures without verifying information or looking at the documents. They just gave these loans AAA ratings without doing due diligence. And so many people came forward to testify, and really nothing was done. And you write about that in your piece, Jesse.
Well, we're conflating a number of things here, but Kevin was talking about mortgage modifications on standard mortgages, and mortgage servicers didn't do a good job of that. They were not working with borrowers to modify mortgages. They were going into sending people into foreclosure. The Obama administration tried to prevent that and tried to encourage modifications with a couple of major programs, but the programs were poorly designed and poorly overseen, and the Obama administration is, yeah, I think that's one of the great failures of the Obama administration, that they didn't help more borrowers. Then we're also talking about robo-signing, which is a different set of issues, the David Dayan specialty. He wrote an entire book about that, and that was kind of foreclosure abuse where the banks didn't have proper paperwork for mortgages and foreclosed on people anyway. And then another issue that was kind of special to IndyMac. IndyMac had a division called Financial Freedom that did reverse mortgages. And reverse mortgages are different from the standard mortgage. An elderly person cashes out from their home equity, essentially, and gets a lump sum, is basically the way it works. And in these cases, One West was particularly aggressive about, had disproportionately more reverse mortgages than almost any other bank, and foreclosed very aggressively. And the 27-cent story that you're talking to was about an elderly person getting kicked out of her home for 27 cents on a reverse mortgage foreclosure. And that is something that will be people will pay some attention to in the confirmation hearings, I suspect.
Yeah, and I think my recollection is that they had at least 35% of the defaults or the foreclosures on reverse mortgages. So they were a large player, but not that large. There were some. I think they had 13% of the reverse mortgages issued, yet 35% of those foreclosed on. So they had,
yeah, they're disproportionately responsible for a big number of reverse mortgage foreclosures. Exactly.
We have a question from Tom in San Jose. The inquiry commission that investigated the causes of the 2008 economic disaster found evidence that several financial executives committed massive fraud that contributed to the crash. However, the Obama Justice Department declined to prosecute the execs. If the administration had prosecuted them, would Steve Mnuchin have been one of the criminal defendants? Kevin, what do you think?
I would think no, because they bought assets. They didn't issue. They weren't part of the creation process. They weren't at the front of the chain. Whereas a Countrywide or I'm trying to think the one Lytton service that had been a Goldman affiliated. There were a couple of really bad actors, and was it State Street? Is my memory right, Jesse? One of the other non-bank lenders.
There's Countrywide, there's Ameriquest,
Ameriquest.
It was one of them. Then there was New Century. There was a variety of non-bank mortgage companies. The FCIC made criminal referrals. They didn't find definitive criminal evidence for a variety of executives, but the executives were, just as Kevin said, responsible for the abuses that led to the financial crisis. Steve Mnuchin is not one of those. He is kind of like a, you know, a bottom feeder investor who came in amid the panic and made a savvy deal with a lot of benefit from the government. So, you know, we can object to the foreclosure practices, but we can't lay the financial crisis at his feet.
But at the hearings, it's going to be very interesting because throughout the whole campaign, the Republicans demonized George Soros as this, you know, monstrous beast who funded every horrible thing in the world, yet the Treasury Secretary, you know, made a lot of money with him, and the guy who shorted the housing market, John Paulson, and the three of them made a pretty nice profit. I think they bought for $1.3 billion and sold for $4.5 billion, if I'm not mistaken. Somewhere in those ballparks, you had basically a fourfold return on investment close to on that IndyMac purchase. So they made out like bandits.
Mnuchin was on CNBC recently. He said, our number one priority is tax reform. This will be the largest tax change since Reagan. We are going to cut corporate taxes, which will bring huge amounts of jobs back to the United States. Kevin Hall, how do you think the media are covering that angle?
Well, we don't know yet until we see the details. This is going to be one of the very, very interesting things. People forget that the actual largest tax change was George Bush's tax cuts that Obama made permanent for
right.
everybody but the rich. That's part of what really blew up our deficit, because that wasn't real responsible to lock in those. And now that's going to be the starting point to knock it even lower. Trump's talking the three categories were 15, 25, and 33. You know, the devil is always in the details. Are they really going to get rid of the mortgage deduction and state interest deduction and all these things that have been kind of sacred cows for the American taxpayer? Are they going to get, you know, are they going to go to 15% but get rid of the research and development credit, the expedited expensing of your capital equipment purchases at a company? It's easy to say it, but once you get into the details, then it's going to be a different animal. The House tax legislation, for those who don't know it, actually has to originate in the House. Paul Ryan and Kevin Brady of the Ways and Means Committee already have a bill that was introduced and later modified. It more or less dovetails with a lot of what Trump likes. So the big question is, you know, can they get Trump onto their plan? And then the next question is, what happens in the Senate, where you've got 85-year-old Orrin Hatch leading the Senate Finance Committee and has said nothing about tax reform? So a lot of questions.
A lot of questions. But just what about that statement that corporate tax cuts will bring huge amounts of jobs back to the United States? I mean, what does history tell us? What about George W. Bush's tax cuts?
Well, he didn't say jobs. He said revenue. And history has taught us that it doesn't bring back gobs of revenue as thought. And you can look at Kansas and Governor Brownback's attempt to slash taxes and suddenly have two years in a row of budget crisis because they don't have revenues coming in. In terms of jobs, that presumes that jobs are overseas for the reason that they're not here, that the market's not attractive. The reason they're overseas is because 90% of your customers are overseas. They've expanded overseas, so I don't see how it would necessarily create jobs. I could see how it could bring revenue back if you made it cheaper to bring your offshore earnings back. But you know, these companies are going to want to invest in foreign countries where they're making money.
We do have one example under the Bush administration where they did a temporary tax cut for companies to repatriate profits from abroad. And the ostensible reason for that was that the companies could bring back the money from profits that was housed abroad, and that would lead to corporate increases in investment, which would be, you know, job creating. And in fact, studies have shown that there weren't jobs created from that, that what instead companies did was buy back stock and increase their dividends, so they just gave it to shareholders, which was not job creating. So, and of course, many of the shareholders are the top executives, so sort of an enriching the executives program instead. So the track record is poor in some of these cases.
And we're already given And we're already given tax breaks for companies. There was tax legislation in the Bush era that gave a tax break for companies that manufactured in the United States, as Bush and into the stimulus era, into the Obama era. And in fact, you know, one of the funny things that happened was the refiners decided they were manufacturers. And now they no longer call themselves the Refining Association. They're now the Fuel Manufacturers Association, and they get tax credits as if they were manufacturers. Domestic manufacturers.
He also said revising Dodd-Frank is the number one priority on the regulatory side. What about Wall Street regulations?
Well, it seems to me like they're going to unwind a lot of Wall Street regulations that we put in post-financial crisis. That's going to make the system more vulnerable. I think that people can have their concerns about Dodd-Frank. I think Dodd-Frank was overly complicated. I think that it allowed for a lot of loopholes. So what I expect them to do is increase the number of loopholes and make the rules less stringent, and that will be a very complicated process that will not be opaque, and it will not take place in public. It will be opaque, so it would be very hard to know exactly what's going on, but the end result will be that the banks will be much less fettered by regulation.
Hmm. And which Donald Trump is going to show up? Because Donald Trump on the campaign trail said he wants to go back to Glass-Steagall and that wall. So if he's serious about it, then he's going to have some issues. And the key thing, the Senate is sometimes described as the place where good legislation goes to die. You've got that 10 vote, you've got to get 60 votes to get past debate to go to a vote. So Democrats, I think, are going to be pretty united on things like the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau and trying to save that in its current form. But you've got a bunch of Democrats coming up for re-election in 2 years. And that's where some of these things, like the derivatives legislation that a lot of the farm companies, that Cargill and those that pressure, have a lot of pressure on the lawmakers, that's where you might see a lot of undoing.
Kevin Hall is Chief National Economic Correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers, and Jesse Eisinger is Senior Investigative Reporter with ProPublica. Kevin and Jesse, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, how are scientists standing up to climate deniers? We'll have a conversation with Penn State climate scientist Michael Mann and the Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist Tom Tolles about their new book, The Madhouse Effect, how climate change denial is threatening our planet, destroying our politics, and driving us crazy. They say pseudoscience or anti-science is too often allowed to masquerade as science, and denialism is allowed to pose as skepticism. Join us at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Helena Murphy is our researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.